Amen. You guys can take a seat. My name is Mike. I'm one of the pastors here at Revision. I'm excited to be here today. How about you? Now we're trying it again. I'm excited to be here today. How about you? All right. So a couple weeks ago, I went up to Wisconsin for a day for a funeral. My college buddy's dad passed away, and the route that it took me to get there was mostly interstates and highways, but as I got closer to this little town where I was headed, my GPS took me on some back roads through some farms and little towns, and I had an experience that made me thankful to be from the Midwest, but also glad I live in an urban area. Because Midwesterners, we're really nice. We're just like a really incredibly polite, kind crew of people. Our aggression is mostly expressed through passive aggression. And I feel like the more rural you get, like the farther out in the sticks, the more pronounced it is. Everybody out there is nice and polite, and that is great, except when you're trying to drive somewhere because nobody goes. That's what I learned. I had one of those experiences in middle of nowhere, Wisconsin, where I pulled up to a four-way stop, and it was like when all four cars get there at once, except I was clearly the fourth. I was just starting to slow down while all three of these cars were stopped, and I got there, and nobody went. It's one of those ones where you're looking around like, are we going to go? Who's going to go? I don't think we're parking here. This can't be the destination. Is it? We're not parking here. Who's going to go? And I look up, and it's three old guys, and they're all waving. Like, no, somebody else go first. Like, you get points in heaven for going last or something like that. And they're shaking their heads. And I look over, and it looked like the guy on my right was about to reach for his door handle to get out of the car and just be like, this is my commitment to not going. And I had this moment of panic. Like, if he does that, how are the other guys going to one-up him? Like, chuck their keys out into the field. Like, I can't even go now. And I'm looking, and they're old. And the one guy has his wife, and she looks super old. And I realize I'd have to help him find the keys. They can't see good. I don't have time to be doing that today. This is a disaster. So I just went. I floored it. And I drove away wondering, what if I wasn't there? What would happen? Like, if four Wisconsin cheese farmers get to an intersection at the same time, what goes down? I think they'd probably just die there. That's what I decided. But the experience was a powerful reminder for me of how frustrating it is to feel stalled and stuck, even for just a few seconds. We're built to keep moving forward. It's part of being human. And the reality for all of us is that we have seasons that last a whole lot longer than my time in the intersection where we feel like life is going nowhere. We're just treading water. And we're broken down by the frustration of plans and dreams and hopes that have stagnated. We're kicking up a brand new series this morning called Treading Water, and I'm really excited for it because we're going to talk about what God has to say to us in that space, about how we can find meaning and hope and progress even when it feels like we're surrounded by an ocean of doubt, fear, and frustration that's impossible to escape. I know there are a lot of us feeling like we're in that spot this morning. And even those of us who don't feel like that, we know exactly what it's like. We've been there before, and all of us will be there again, treading water. And some of us are treading water in our marriages. We're treading water in our friendships, in our relationships with our parents, or with our kids, or with other family members. Some of us are treading water with addiction, these self-destructive choices we keep making that we can't seem to get past. Some of us are treading water when it comes to our health, or the health situation of a loved one that's kind of just left us in a holding pattern. Some of us are treading water with our finances, feeling like we're barely keeping our heads above water, and we don't know how we're ever going to get to a spot where we can move forward. Some of us are treading water at work, feeling ground up by the daily grind, or at school, just trying to figure out what's next and how we move forward. Some of us are treading water when it comes to our faith. We've been going through the motions. We've been checking off the right boxes, but deep down, we're wondering if God kind of left us out of his story because we don't feel like we're growing at all. It's really easy in life to feel stuck, but God has something to say to us there. This morning, we're actually going to take a look at the story of a guy who was about as stuck as you could be. He was locked up and chained up, and we're going to see four truths that we need to embrace if we're going to stop treading water and move toward the future God has for us. And the guy in the story is named Peter, and this particular story actually happens in the book of Acts, chapter 12. So if you have a Bible or a Bible with you today, you can open it up to Acts 12. Acts is sandwiched right between John and Romans, which is kind of a silly place for Acts to be because it's the second half of a letter written by Luke. It should probably be after Luke. But Luke was a doctor who wrote this letter to his friend named Theophilus to tell him all about the life of Jesus and this movement called the church that was blowing up in the first century. And by Acts 12, like, the story of the church is incredible. It's spreading like wildfire. It did not just die off like the Jewish and Roman authorities had hoped it would when they killed Jesus, because Jesus didn't stay dead. He rose again, and all these eyewitnesses decided that they would risk everything to tell everybody about the good news of his story. But that didn't make the social and religious and political powers that be very happy. And by the time Acts 12 is going down, it's really difficult for the church in Jerusalem. For starters, there's a famine, so everybody's hungry and resources are scarce. And also, the Jewish religious authorities are conspiring with the Roman political authorities, namely a guy named Herod Antipas, who's the governor of the region, to persecute the church. And this is what we read in Acts chapter 12, starting in verse 1. It says, "It was about this time that King Herod arrested some who belonged to the church, intending to persecute them." And in the original Greek, it literally says he laid violent hands on the members of the church. He had James, the brother of John, one of the 12 disciples, put to death with the sword. When he saw that this met with approval among the Jews, he realized, ooh, they like me when I do that. The political power is coming my way. I can get a little bit more clout if I keep killing off these church people. So he proceeded to seize Peter also. This happened during the festival of unleavened bread. After arresting him, he put him in prison, handing him over to be guarded by four squads of four soldiers each. Herod intended to bring him out for public trial after the Passover. Now, Peter is not just one of the 12 disciples. He is the key leader at this moment in the church in Jerusalem, and he is stuck. He is as stuck can possibly be. I mean, Herod's taken no chances. This is a guy, like, if you know anything about the story of Peter, you know he's not exactly Einstein, okay? He's not a guy who's probably going to be able to go Tony Stark in a cave, turn himself into Iron Man, and escape. He's too dumb for that. But Herod gives him 16 legionnaires to guard him, sticks him in a jail cell, chains him up to two soldiers inside the jail just in case. And his plan is to wait for this Jewish festival of Passover to be over. And then, while all the Jews in Jerusalem are really excited because they just celebrated, he's going to put the cherry on top of the Passover and get himself a whole lot more love and a whole lot more adoration as the ruler by chopping off Peter's head for them. So what can the church do? They got nothing, and they're powerless. And so they decide to do the only thing they can. We read this in verse 5. It says, "So Peter was kept in prison, but the church was earnestly praying to God for him." I love this verse. Herod kept Peter in prison because he intended to kill him, but the church was praying continually. See, now we got a battle on our hands. Herod's prison versus the church's prayers. Herod's plans versus God's purpose. And for a while, it looks like Herod's going to win. It gets to be the night before Peter's trial. And let's be straight, this trial's a fixer. This is just a dog and pony show, so all the authorities can parade him out there and accuse him of being a blasphemer and grandstand a little bit in front of the public. It's not like if Peter makes a great closing argument, they're going to say, "Oh yeah, wow, I didn't consider that, not guilty." And he knows it. He knows that tomorrow is his last day on the planet. So he's in jail and he's freaking out. He's pacing back and forth. He's crying out in prayer. He's trying to convince everybody that he's been unjustly imprisoned and he shouldn't be there. And in verse 6, we read about it. Luke tells us the night before Herod was to bring him to trial, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers bound with two chains and sentries to guard at the entrance. What? Sleeping? That almost has to be a typo. Surely Luke meant to say that Peter was pacing or worrying or crying in the fetal position. I think that's what I would have been doing. Sleeping, listen, I'll be real with you. There's not enough Ambien on the planet that could knock me out in that situation. I'd have been losing it in that jail. And I think most of us would, but Peter's just out cold, chained to two guards. And this is the same Peter, right, who, when Jesus told his disciples, they're going to arrest me and kill me, said, no, that's not going to happen. And he tried to tell God what was going to go down. This is the same Peter who, while Jesus was getting arrested, lost his mind and decided to sword a dude and cut off his ear. That Peter has now been arrested peacefully, and he is peacefully resting in Herod's prison. It begs the question, what did Peter know that the rest of us don't know? What did Peter know that allowed him to sleep? Well, here's what Peter knew. And it's what I hope all of us can know this morning as we walk out of here. In these places where we feel chained up and beat down and stuck, God's purpose prevails over people's plans. Every single time. Like, Herod had plans to cut off Peter's head. The Jewish religious leaders had plans to persecute the church. But Peter knew, he knew that God had a purpose. And so whatever happened, whether it was escape or execution, whether it was deliverance or death, the next morning God was going to win. Peter's sleeping because he has this incredible, overwhelming sense of peace about whatever lies ahead in life, and he has no fear because he knows what lies ahead in death. He's just sawing logs chained up between two guards. And then, suddenly, an angel of the Lord appeared, and a light shone in the cell. He struck Peter on the side and woke him up. "Quick, get up," he said. And then the chains fell off Peter's wrists. This is so cool. And there are a couple things in this verse that blow my mind. First, I think it's great that it says the angel woke Peter up by striking him in the side. Most scholars agree that that's a kind Bible way of saying the angel kicked him in the ribs, which that's just funny. I'm sorry. Like, that's just, this angel, right, could pass through prison walls. This angel could illuminate dark spaces. And so he probably, like, and you know it's a he, because a girl angel would have never thought that's the best way to wake up Peter. But he probably could have woken up Peter without even touching him. And this has nothing to do with anything other than it cracks me up to imagine, like, this guy's like, oh, I'm on a mission from God. I might as well have some fun while I'm at it. And if anyone in history deserves it, it's Peter. And he's just thinking, like, how else should I wake him up? And gets a big dumb grin on his face and just, get up. You guys, the Bible's fun. You should read it. You should read it between Sundays. It's good, even when I'm not up here talking about it, I promise you. But here's the other thing that happens in this verse. It says the angel kicked Peter in the ribs, and then Peter stood up, and then the chains fell off. And I don't know if you caught this, but that's the wrong order. The natural sequence would be the chains fell off Peter's wrists, and then he stood up. But it doesn't say that. It says the angel told him to get up, and Peter stood up, and then the chains fell off his wrists. Are you seeing this? So often in life, when we're treading water, we expect that the chains are going to fall off before we're going to be asked to stand up. We're waiting for God to remove every single obstacle from our path, for God to take out every single challenge in our way before we'll finally feel free enough to obey him. But it doesn't work like that. And if that's what you're waiting on, you're probably going to be treading water for a long time. Here's the deal when it comes to faith. You get up and then chains fall off. Obedience paves the way for progress. If you want to see movement, you got to move. Trusting God enough to take the step that's right in front of you. To do the things you know he's asking you to do, even in the situations where you don't know if it's going to end up the way you want it to go, even in the situations where you don't know what the outcome's going to be, even in the situations where you don't know the step that lies beyond this step, even in the situations where you know it's going to be hard, trusting God to take that step that's right in front of you is the thing that paves the way to move forward from the frustration of this present moment. Look, if Peter doesn't stand up, the chains stay on. If you don't do what you know God's asking you to do, if you don't live into who you know God's calling you to be, you will miss out. You won't get to see God do that thing that he's going to do that you didn't know he was going to do in your life. And Peter didn't know the outcome when the angel showed up. He didn't know the outcome when the angel kicked him in the side. It's pretty clear from the story. He didn't even know the outcome after the chains fell off. He just obeyed. And I can't help but wonder how many of us would have died right there in Herod's prison. think I would have. I think if the angel showed up and I was chained to two guards lying on the floor and the angel was like, hey, get up, I'd have been like, why? Also, who are you? Can I see some ID? I'd really like you to fill me in on, I'm chained here. And even if you can break the chains, Mr. Shiny Guy, then guards and bars and gates. And so that seems like a waste of my time. I'm going back to sleep. But Peter shows us obedience paves the way for progress. And it happens one step at a time as God removes obstacles, one obstacle at a time. And I love what happens next in Peter's story here. I love it because it just is my life every day as a parent. Like either Peter is really dazed and confused because he was sleeping, or his personality is similar to my 5-year-old twins, because this is what goes down. The angel told him, put on your clothes and sandals. It's like, Peter, hey, bro, I just released your chains, and you're standing there in your tighty-whities. We're not going outside like that. I'm not going to be seen with you in those. Can you just please put on your clothes? Can you get them on? Thank you. Now, your shoes, where are your shoes? They're right in front of you. No, wrong feet. Oh, my goodness. Can you just get them on? So Peter did. Wrap your cloak around you and follow me, the angel told him. And the angel's like, now your coat. Can you get on the coat? Yes, you have to wear a coat. It's cold. I don't care if you don't want to wear a coat. Just put it on. So Peter did. Like, this is just step-by-step instructions. He's doing nothing that he's not told to do specifically. And Peter followed him out of the prison, but he had no idea what the angel was doing was really happening. He thought he was seeing a vision. They passed the first and second guards, came to the iron gate leading to the city. It opened for them by itself, and they went through it. And when they had walked the length of one street, suddenly the angel left him. Then Peter came to himself and said, holy smokes, now without a doubt, I know the Lord has sent his angel and rescued me from Herod's clutches and from everything the Jewish people were hoping would happen. Peter was stuck as stuck could be. He was treading water in a prison cell, and then God showed up. And in faith, he took one step at a time. I mean, he had no idea until he was all the way out and looking around what God was really doing. But he had enough faith to just keep doing, moment by moment, what God asked him to do. You guys, faith is getting dressed when you don't know your destination. Faith is deciding, I can't see 10 steps ahead, but I don't need to see 10 steps ahead to take the step that God has placed right in front of my face. I think one of the most fascinating things about this story is what God does and what God doesn't do along the way. Like God breaks the chains off Peter's wrist because Peter couldn't break the chains. God knocks out the guards because Peter couldn't have knocked out the guards. God opens the gate because there was no way that Peter could have opened that gate. But God also tells Peter to stand himself up, put his own clothes on, and walk himself out onto the street. He didn't just whisk Peter away to a different place, even though he could have, because there was something Peter needed to learn along the way. And it's this: God will do for you what you cannot do, but he will rarely do for you what you can do. He's inviting you to be a part of the story, to step out boldly in faith, and he promises he will meet you there when you do. And there are so many stories throughout the history of the church, so many stories throughout the Bible where God meets people. He shows up after they take that one step of faith. One of my favorite stories in the entire Bible is found in 1 Samuel. It's about this moment in the history of Israel where this group of people called the Philistines are oppressing the Israelites. They've kind of taken over. They've stolen a bunch of the stuff. They've killed a bunch of people. They're stealing the crops. They actually took all the weapons away from the Israelites, and they kidnapped all the blacksmiths so Israel couldn't make any more weapons. There's only two swords in the entire nation of Israel. They belong to King Saul and his son Jonathan. Now they're attacking again, and Saul is just paralyzed by fear. He's like, I don't know how in the world I'm supposed to fight these people. I don't know what we're going to do, and they're going to win, and they're going to steal all our crops, and they're going to kill more people. And some of the Israelites have actually joined the Philistine army. They're like, it's too late for us. We better fight with the winners. And then some other ones are hiding out. Some people from Saul's army, they're hiding in holes, just hoping that no one sees them. That's how bad it's gotten. And Saul, in a panic, decides, what I should probably do is nothing. And eventually Jonathan, his son, gets so fed up with that. He says, this is a God or nothing moment. I would rather die doing something than live doing nothing. It's got to matter more to do something right than nothing wrong. And so he talks to his armor bearer, and he's like, let's go attack them. These two guys march out onto the field to attack an enemy army of 10,000. And Jonathan knows, if God shows up, there's nothing the Philistines can do to stop him. And if God doesn't show up, he's going to get killed and be forever remembered as Prince John the Stupid. But he goes. He's got the only weapon Israel has, and he walks out there with his sword, and God meets him on the field. Like, the Philistines are so shocked that anyone's daring to attack them that they panic, and then God sends an earthquake, and the ground is shaking, and from a long way away, it finally wakes up Saul. And Saul's like, what is going on? They're running around, like their earth is quaking, something must be happening. Who's over there attacking them? And his generals take stock of the men. They're like, only two guys, Jonathan and his armor bearer. And I honestly believe that if it was anyone other than Jonathan, fearful, faithless Saul would have been like, what an idiot, let him die. But it's his son, so he's moved to action. And this thing happens that you don't see happen very often in the Bible. In 1 Samuel 14, verse 18, it says this. Saul said to Ahijah, the priest, bring the ark of God. At that time, it was with the Israelites. Saul's like, we got to pray. Okay, so something's going down. We need to pray and ask God exactly what he wants us to do. And while Saul was talking to the priest, the tumult in the Philistine camp increased more and more. So Saul said to the priest, withdraw your hand. That's an ancient Hebrew way of saying, stop praying. You guys probably didn't believe that the Bible says to stop praying anywhere, but it does. And it's absolutely the right call here. Saul realizes the earth is shaking. God is moving. Now is probably not the moment for me to pretend that I'm really pious and ask God specifically what his plans are for the battle. He couldn't be making that more clear. Like, it's right in front of my face. God is telling me to stop praying and attack. And so they go and they fight, and it inspires all those traitors to do what traitors do. All those people that were fighting with the Philistines are like, well, the Philistines are losing now. We're back to Israel, ha-ha. And then all the people who are hiding out in holes are like, oh, the fight looks like it's going good. And they stream down from the hills, and Israel wins a great victory over their oppressors and their enemies because Jonathan did what he could do, and God did what he couldn't. I think it's really easy in life and faith to convince ourselves that we are waiting on God when the exact opposite is true. He's waiting on us. We're just experiencing paralysis by overanalysis. We're stuck out there in the middle of the lake treading water, and we're praying, God, I will not move until you give me complete clarity on this. How is it that you want me to get to shore? Were you thinking backstroke, freestyle, butterfly? That hurts my shoulders, my rotator cuff. I don't think but I can soldier chicken airplane. Will you soldier chicken airplane? Just tell me. I'm just waiting on you. And God is going, remove your hand. You cannot mess up my plans. I'm going to get you where I want to get you. The only wrong decision is to keep treading water. Just start swimming, and I will meet you there. And that's Peter's story. He had zero clarity at any point along the journey about what God was going to do. And neither did the church that was praying for him. They were praying as an act of obedience without any belief whatsoever that it would actually work. Seriously, check it out. Peter's out on the street. He realizes what God did. And then Luke tells us, when this had dawned on him, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, also called Mark, where many people had gathered and were praying. Peter knocked on the outer entrance, and a servant named Rhoda came to answer the door. When she recognized Peter's voice, she was so overjoyed that she ran back without opening the door and exclaimed, Peter's at the door! You're out of your mind, they told her. When she kept insisting that it was so, they said, it must be his angel. But Peter kept on knocking, and when they opened the door and saw him, they were astonished. Peter motioned with his hand for them to be quiet and described how the Lord had brought him out of prison. Tell James and the other brothers and sisters about this, he said, and then he left for another place. This is one of the most ridiculous sequences of events in the entire Bible. Like, first we got crazy Rhoda, and she's like, oh, God, it's Peter's here. Ah, you guys, Peter, we're praying for this, and now he's here. And she just leaves him out on the street. He's a fugitive. If someone saw him, he's going to get arrested again. But she doesn't think about that. She just runs back and tells everybody. And the church, like, there are about 5,000 Christians in Jerusalem at this point in time. And they met in groups, in houses. It's a unique and brilliant concept, these house groups, because they were doing life and faith together, because Jesus told them that's how they're meant to do it, which interestingly enough, segue. In the back today, there's these sign-up sheets for this thing that we do at Revision called house groups, where you do life and faith together. And in the Bible, it says they can change your life and change the world. So maybe you should go back there and learn more about them. Right after the service is over, I'll be there. Do that. So anyways, side note, Rhoda, she runs back and she tells them, like, you guys, preacher's at the door. And they're like, you're crazy. I like you, man, but you're crazy. Like, God cannot have answered that prayer. We weren't expecting that one. Which is like so encouraging to me. Do you guys ever have moments where you feel like God's calling you to pray big prayers? And then you have this self-doubt deep inside your soul. Like, if I pray this big prayer, but I doubt that God's going to deliver on it, will he still even answer? Like, here's the entire church praying without a shred of doubt that God would not answer them. And he did anyway. He did anyway. They just took one step of obedience. They clearly had no idea what the future holds, but God met them in a way that changed the world, that poured gasoline all over this movement that was already on fire. And I think about that story, and I think about Jonathan's story, and I realize, like, sometimes in life, especially in the moments where we have been treading water, what we need most is courage, not clarity. We don't always need to see way down the road. We just need the courage to take the next step. It was about 5 years ago this week. I was leading a mission trip of about 40 high school students in South Texas. I was walking around at 5 a.m. praying. Season of treading water, season of feeling stuck, not knowing what was next. And I said, God, just give me clarity. If you give me clarity on what you want me to do, I'll do anything, anytime, anywhere. Give me clarity, give me clarity, give me clarity. And I just felt in my soul the word no. I don't know if any of you have ever had an angry prayer moment, but I have. And I was like, I was yelling silently because there are other people around, and I'm from the Midwest. I'm nice. I'm not going to yell out loud, but I was like, what do you mean? What do you mean, no? If you just show me the next 10 years, I will chase the vision that you give me for the next 10 years. I think I meant that. I really will do anything. Would you just give me clarity? And I had this overwhelming sense, no. You don't need clarity. I am never showing you 10 years down the road. You don't even need to see 2 years down the road. There's one step that I put right in front of your face. Take it or don't. You need courage, not clarity. And I walked out at 5:15 in the morning, and I called Jenny, and I said, we're moving to Des Moines to plant a church. Because it's the only step I could see. And I'm convinced this morning, you guys, if we will believe deep down in our souls, that God's purpose prevails over people's plans, that obedience paves the way for progress, that God will do for us what we cannot do when we do what we can, and that what we need most is courage, not clarity. If we believe that, then we will begin to move forward from this frustrating, painful space. And that movement will come an inch at a time. It won't immediately feel like everything's resolved and life is the way we want it to be and it's easy and it's simple. It'll be hard every step. But I challenge you today, in whatever it is for you, whatever area where you felt like you've been treading water, to start swimming and trust God will meet you there. Because I think if we don't, and I think if we just keep allowing ourselves to be beat down by the world and paralyzed by fear, allowing ourselves to believe this lie that we're waiting on God when the truth is he's waiting on us, then we're going to be stuck here. And we're going to keep on believing that maybe we got left out of God's story and maybe our future really is devoid of possibility and devoid of hope. But if we do, I believe God will show up and we will find meaning and momentum and hope even in the places where our last reservoirs of hope were drying up inside of us. And we'll not only find it for ourselves, but we'll be able to inspire the world around us that's desperate for hope as well. You guys, we live in a world that's so messed up. So many people are hurting. So many people are feeling stuck. But I look back at these stories and I think, like, Jonathan's simple act of obedience to walk out onto the field with his sword, because his sword was the only weapon Israel had. Peter's simple act of obedience to stand himself up and walk himself out on the street because his feet were the only weapon that he had. the church's simple act of obedience to pray, even when they didn't know if it would work, because prayer was the only weapon they had. That stuff changed the world. Those simple steps of obedience literally wrote a better future for all the people around them. Like Jonathan's act of obedience inspired all these cowardly people who joined up with the Philistines to be like, no, we're fighting for God's side. It inspired these people hiding up in the hills to come down and join the fight. Peter's action and the church's action, when Peter got set free, it inspired thousands of people to say, all right, I am all in. I'm giving my life and my future to Jesus. I'm putting it all on the line, including my life and my freedom, to tell people the good news of this story. And sure, all those inspired people were bandwagoners, right? Those traitors who were like, oh, wow, now Israel's winning. We'll fight on that side. Go Warriors. No, just kidding. Go Raptors. Like, I'm gonna root for the team that's winning. And all those people were hiding in the hills. They waited. It wasn't like they started right when the attack happened. They waited, and they're like, we're winning. Let's go. And all the people that got inspired to put their faith in Jesus after Peter got set free, they were people who'd been holding Jesus at an arm's length because they were scared. And finally, they were inspired. And in sports, we hate bandwagon fans who are late to the party. But in Jesus, we love them. I don't care how anybody gets here or how late they are. This message of the gospel, that Jesus died and rose again so we could be forgiven and set free, the church, this is the wagon, baby, so get in the band. When we step out in faith, when we stop treading water and just start swimming, God moves in our lives in a way that inspires us and inspires the broken, scared, stuck people our lives are crashing into every day. So let's go. Will you guys pray with me? Heavenly Father, thank you so much for not abandoning us to the hopeless spaces in our lives, for not leaving us broken, for not abandoning us to our sin and our hopelessness. Thank you. Then in a pain-filled, evil-filled world, your purposes are going to prevail over people's plans. We have hope in life and no fear in death because of your love. God, would you just help us? So many of us are sitting here this morning feeling stuck, feeling beaten down and a little bit broken. Would you help us take that first step? Would you meet us there? We just thank you so much for being a God who does that. A God whose great love not only shows up in our everyday lives, in the places where we're hurting and frustrated, but your great love caused you to step out of eternity into history and give everything for us. God, let us be a people who live that good news every day and who know that when we step forward, you meet us there because that's who you are. Just thank you for your love. In Jesus' name, amen.